Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and it's all about compliance. And as a matter of fact, folks, it's not something that you have to just, you know, plant a seed and water. It takes a lot more than just that. In other words, we need to actually be the ones that are ensuring that the light is there, that the what is adequate for this idea of restoring or taking our government back and restoring our constitutional republic is not something that we can just, you know, let it be to the forces of nature. Because right now, evil is working and manipulating everything. Things will not fix themselves if we use the course of nature. We have to actively engage. We have to confront evil. We have to oppose every infraction, every evil, every subversive thing that is happening within our government. And the first thing we've got, we have to get ourselves in check. We can't be the problem while we're seeking the change, because we've created a conflict of interest. You want to maintain these stipends of these statist programs and so forth. The only thing that I believe we have to maintain, because it would impact too many people and it would have too big of a, I'll just say, a negative impact, would be Social Security. Social Security is one of those things that needs to be maintained. I'm not convinced about Medicaid, Medicare, and all those other things, because that's just government's involvement in healthcare. I believe if we get government completely out of it and we get the communities and churches and the institutions that were actually built and designed best for providing compassionate services, then I think we would actually be well on our way without having to look over our shoulder and ending Social Security so the future generations will not be strapped down with this anvil or with this albatross, however you want, this yoke. Because the more we can provide people the full liberty and control over their own lives and being able to make their own decisions, you know what? It may take a generation or two, because there's going to be people that are going to suffer because they've marginalized the importance of putting away for your, you know, retirement, putting away, you know, to try to account for all contingencies. Now, not everybody's going to have that perfect life where, you know, those contingencies don't come in. As a matter of fact, it's always the person that doesn't plan for the contingency that gets hit with it. Usually. So with that, we're here to help. And the process that you need to be engaged in is demanding compliance. We need to be petitioning our government, holding them accountable, and demanding that they either do their job or they need to be removed. So as we convince the people, as we convince the public of the facts, how hard will it be if the public actually says, you know what, the facts are the facts. You're violating your oath. You don't deserve to be in office. And if you're not going to enforce the removal of yourself, then we're not going to see that you are fit to be reelected. Once we actually start invoking these changes and actually forcing, folks, there may come a time, if you're not doing your job, there may come a time when we may actually have to vote for a Democrat or a progressive to go into that the challenger seat. The challenger has proven that they're not worthy of that position. Even though we've got a Democrat and or a progressive, I can show you several cases where you have a Democrat or a progressive in a seat that belongs, really, because the voters are what you would call conservative or, you know, patriotic, and they behave better. But still, they're still not going to get where we need them to be. We need champions on the Constitution. And ergo, it buys you time to find a real tangible replacement. And I don't think you need to worry about tangible replacements if you're organized in holding government accountable. Those people will naturally rise to the top, because they'll become the champions in saying, hold me accountable. That's going to be just natural. The Thomas Jeffersons, James Madisons, Rufus Kings, all of the type of men that the framers were, they rose to the top because they rose to the challenge. Once we start, and as once people start realizing that if we all lock arms and we all hold, you demand accountability, then this is where things just start breaking free. Be a part of the solution. Stop being a part of the problem, because if you're not doing anything, then you are a part of the problem. Your heart may be in the right place. You may be fasting and praying, and that's great. It's applaudable. It's laudable, I should say. However, we are integral in this government process. It is our duty and our responsibility to support and defend that Constitution, not just be passive. This is why people need to start getting this. You need to worry about your salvation when you go to church, and don't worry about your salvation when you're looking at our government. You need to be worried about whether those people that are elected representing you are actually fully supporting the Constitution. That's all you need to do. And with that, Sean, welcome back. We've got more constitutional compliance. As a matter of fact, let me just say this. Folks, Sean, you're there, right? Are you muted?
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. So Sean has been, since he's been, you know, working with me for, what, about 9 months now? 9, 10 months?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay, so since Sean's been working with me, he kind of took it upon himself this January 1st to start going through the shows and creating keywords as well as descriptions for the shows. And so I just got those. Actually, I probably got them about a week or two ago, but I just finally got around to updating the website. So I just updated the website to March 18th. And so we now have what I've added from January 1st to March, or actually you go to February 7th, 16th, because there are some, all the shows that are missing from the 16th to the 18th, they weren't there. So I know Sean is probably going to jump on those, but that's okay. We'll get to those and we'll get those things injected. But what we want to do is we want to let you know that there's been added language to make it easier for you to find a show like when we talked about the militia, when we kind of broke and did a show really special, away from content and very focused on the militia. So I think that might be there, may not be there, because it's been, I have no idea if that was before the 16th or after the 16th. Anywho, but thank you so much for doing that.
You're quite welcome, sir. It's for my grandchildren.
There you go, because folks, we need your help. And the more we can improve, you know, the information, I know my website could be improved, and I've got to get to my host domain managing company, my ISP, and say, hey, you know, help me out. What do I need to do so that it's a little bit more... I'm not too worried whether I interface with your phones as best as possible and optimized. I am trying to make it so that I'm not going to give away and actually surrender to Google's security demands, because it's all about controlling and having access to who's doing everything. This is what the HTTPS, you have to create these certifications, and you give them your data to create that. So to create these secure sites, this is one of the reasons why we're not participating in e-commerce. So if you see my website's not secure, well, don't worry about it. You're not giving me any of your personal information. Nothing. And as a matter of fact, we gather no information. We have no Trojan horses. I've been hit a few times, and I get my radio show knocked out by China or whomever's denying the service, whoever it is. You know, every once in a while we have these little problems, but my site is secure. As a matter of fact, any type of changes, because whenever I do my updates, I do a full check on my site to find out what type of changes, if any, have occurred, because I'll delete those changes and update them. Or I should say the application I use will do that. And I had to start doing that because I actually had files changed out. This was when we had some problems with not using secure FTP because my ISP wasn't using it at that point in time. So now that we are, it's life's much better and more secure. So, but don't worry, we're not gaining any information on you. Believe me, we don't want to know. I have too many other things to forget. So with that... We are still doing the Constitutional Convention, and I think we probably got about another, I would say probably a couple more weeks to go. And we've been at this since the very end, I think, of January 20-something. So it'll probably take, looking retrospectively, we've probably got a full 2 months, 2.5 months for the Constitutional Convention. We're probably going to spend about 3 months going through the ratification debates. Then we'll start flying through a lot of different documentation, the Assumption Acts, those types of things, so that we can kind of cover things sequentially to going up to the interposition with Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. But, you know, if you go, I think we have the curriculum. We've covered the curriculum before. And so we're going to do this all sequentially this year so that you can kind of see when things really started going sideways, when Congress was really pushing and breaching the Constitution and getting things unconstitutionally done within states and so forth. So anyway, the topic that we're covering is still property, and we kind of just finished off with a very good discourse by Mr. Governor Morris, and we're now going to have a little bit of feedback from different gentlemen, and the next gentleman is Mr. Dayton, because he's seconding the motion, and who created the motion? Actually, it was Mr. Morris, because it starts off, he moved to insert, quote, unquote, free, before the word inhabitants, and so Mr. Dayton then seconded that. But go ahead and read Mr. Dayton, and then Mr. Sherman, Mr. Pinckney, and Mr. Pennsylvania, or not Mr. Mr. Wilson, Pennsylvania, I'm sorry. But when you're done with that, then we can look at how they were receptive to changing this idea of inserting this free inhabitants. Okay, so anyway, because it's all about, and as a matter of fact, one of the things we didn't mention, if you actually look above the Mr. Governor Morris on that, what you just read yesterday, this is where the idea of move to insert the words, quote unquote, not exceeding, before the words one for every 40,000, which was agreed to, no contest. So, in other words, that's when that got placed into the Constitution. And the ratio of representation was 1 to 40,000. And you've heard me say this before, it was changed later on the 17th of September, the day they were signing the Constitution, because of George Washington. He felt that was too high. He thought that adequate representation should be 30,000. Anyway, so let's go ahead and get back to reading through these four comments by these four delegates, and then I'll make a comment on what ended up happening, and then we can just move forward to the next one. So go ahead. Thank you.
Mr. Dayton seconded the motion. He did it, he said, that his sentiments on the subject might appear, whatever might be the fate of the amendment. Mr. Sherman did not regard the admission of the Negroes into the ratio of representation as liable to such insuperable objections. It was the free men of the southern states who were in fact to be represented according to the taxes paid by them, and the Negroes are only included in the estimate of the taxes. This was his idea of the matter. Mr. Pinckney of South Carolina considered the fisheries and the western frontier as more burdensome to the United States than the slaves. He thought this could be demonstrated if the occasion were a proper one. Mr. Wilson of Pennsylvania thought the motion premature. An agreement to the clause would be no bar to the object of it.
Okay, so interesting. And Mr. Pinckney, I guess the question I probably would have pushed back with is, so you're telling me that the Western lands might rise up and you know, revolt against us? Or what was the other one? There was Western lands and...
Fisheries.
Yeah, the fisheries. So the fisheries are going to revolt against us and, you know, basically, you know, overthrow their state governments, i.e. the slave states? No. It's like comparing a nut to fruit. They're completely different species. I mean, no way. The fact that they're playing this game of trying to obviate what they're doing, and that Governor Morris, I think, did a really good comprehensive job in identifying that this was empowering a very select few people. Because when you really think about it, who has the best representation in a slave state? The man that owns the most slaves, right? Because if you have four or five plantations and have this one congressional district of four or five plantations, and then you have the rest of the state because there's that many slaves on those plantations, those four or five men have their own representative compared to the rest of the state. Folks, I'm hoping you understand this is why he was calling them out for this, because now the power is really vested in these slaveholders, and they're going to drive policies, and they're going to get everything. Governor Morris, I think, in some ways, was correct, but in other ways, I think he thought that they would have general powers, because he's kind of inserted that. He alluded to the fact that they would be able to almost do anything, and that's not true. They would be able to determine, you know, quickly whether we're going to war or not, and they could easily throw the northern states into war because they would be controlling those votes. But the reality is, and I've said this before, what is the problem? And I just want to see if I've mentioned this to you or not, because if I haven't, then we'll take note of this. What is the problem in representation in slavery versus industry or factories and, you know, those types of labor markets?
Well, I think one thing is that the slaveholders could always get more slaves, and that would give them more representation, where they're just purchasing the slaves and they automatically get representation.
Yeah,
the other industries, uh-huh, they would have to actually build the industry from all facets to get more representation.
Yeah, okay, so let's play with that. So a plantation holder is going to employ enough slaves to get the job done, but not too many, because they do create a huge burden. They're a huge threat, because any person being taken, you know, outside their own free will and being subjected to slavery and hard work and what they're doing on these plantations would, you know, they all would do anything and everything they can if the opportunity arose to break free, to get away, and to go back home or whatever they could do. they do not want to be in that circumstances condition. So therefore the plantation has to maintain a level of control over them. So the more slaves they get, the more, you know, slave handlers they have to have. And that becomes an overhead with, you know, their business and so forth. But the real thing that I'm pointing out is that when you take 100 acres of land, you're going to yield so much. And so the real reason why you would need more slaves if you had more land. And if you had more land, you'd be able to produce more. But you wouldn't just take 100 acres and say, well, I just want more slaves just for representation. That would be a bad business decision, because they would have to pay more on overhead, and they would basically have a diminishing returns on their profits. In other words, they'd be eating their profits for representation. But if they grew their plantation by buying out, you know, local farms and local properties and so forth, so that they could grow their plantation and increase their yield, because over there, there's this, you know, there's this thing called marginal cost, right? This growing, you know, yield on efficiencies. When your plantation gets big enough, next thing you know, your plantation almost becomes self-sustaining, because when you have the ability to, you know, because this is George Washington's plantation, being one of the biggest in the United States, the Mount Vernon estate, he had his own ironworks, where he was making his own nails and tools and so forth, and the things that he needed for building and that type of stuff. He had his own mill of cutting wood. He had the ability to basically not buy anything from the stores other than staples, things that he wasn't growing that he wanted to have. And so when you look at these larger plantations, they become capped. Now, these little industries that Washington was creating increased a per capita per acre, because he was doing things for himself so that he wouldn't have to pay the cost of other manufacturing and so forth and so on. And actually, he was selling that stuff. So he was dabbling in both industry as well as agrarian or farming. Because when you look at slavery and plantations, that's agrarian. But tying the two together, you're kind of creating your own self-sustaining system. So bottom line is that you can only have so many people per acre where you don't have a diminishing return on, you know, having too many slaves. So that was my point. In population per acre, a plantation can only have so many before they start losing money. At a factory, though, you can actually have a factory on a fraction of a plantation and employ lots of people and have a lot of people living in the boroughs and the communities around it, and you'd have a high dense population. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So when
I should have said this, but that was my intention when I said that.
Okay.
Not just getting more slaves for representation and like having four or five times as many slaves as you need on the plantation. No, you would expand the plantation,
right?
And you know that you have more slaves to work more land,
right?
And your profit margin stays the same.
Yes.
You're not paying for any labor.
Okay, so as I look at the cost and the representation, in a way, Governor Morris was incorrect, because if he didn't see the factories and the rising of industry in America as the real challenge and the real opportunities for people to have jobs. And this is why they were talking. And Madison was the one that actually pointed it out. He says, I don't believe freeholders are going to be, you know, we're going to have a lot of freeholders. We're going into break right now. So what I'll do is I'll take a quick pause and we'll come back talking about Madison and how he kind of, you know, shined the light on this alternative theory from what, you know, Mr. Morris had been saying, and it wasn't right after this last diatribe. But anyway, when we come back, we'll kind of talk about this and I'll just give you the hindsight being 2020 or close to 2020 as we possibly could at this point. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so bottom line, now Madison was the one that actually came up with, you know, this injection that there is this trend, there is this movement in America of factories and more opportunities for people, you know, the kids, instead of working the farm and being a slave handler or manager or what have you, and the plantations, they could just go work in a factory and, you know, instantly make money. When did you get paid on a plantation? I mean, if the plantation owner had the bank to pay you on a regular basis, then you got paid regularly. But 9 times out of 10, you didn't get paid but once a year. Because back in those days, nobody had the resources of having a bank. Maybe the big ones, the bigger the ones, okay, possibly. This is why, you know, when you look at the Bible, when did men pay their tithes? They paid their tithes at the time of harvest, or at the time of when they took their commodities to the market to make money. That's when they paid their tithes, so that they knew what, you know, they had to pay tithes on. And, or they, you know, they could basically look and, okay, I've yielded 100 bushels, so I've got to pay tithes on 10 of the bushels, what have you. But anyway, my point is that Madison was looking at this more right than anybody else. And so when you, this is why, as I started reading these, I stumbled into this paradigm that helped me see that what the compromise provided was this way forward that the free states would ultimately start becoming more and more free states and would outnumber the slave states to where there would be a significant enough in the Senate so that you'd have 2/3, if not more, free states in the Senate, where they could literally amend the Constitution and get rid of slavery by changing the Constitution to do so. That is the only method of changing this law. It's the only method. We can't come to find out when you can't, when there's no way of obtaining the change that's within the Constitution. Well, the Lord provided a different way, didn't he? And so as we kind of look at what ended up happening with the Monroe underneath Monroe, the Missouri Compromise of 1820, the fact that they did that and inflicted slavery upon, you know, half the states coming into the Union, then it became heir apparent that the southern states just made they had a big, huge, political, unconstitutional political win and were able to protect their institution of slavery. And unfortunately, people like George Mason and so forth are already dead. And those people that, you know, saw what was going on were, you know, a little dumbfounded. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, there was just a few that I know of There may have been others, but I know because we have the documentation of John G. Jackson asking Madison, hey, you know, we're seeing these things. They're not making sense. We need you to give us the notes on the Constitutional Convention so we can understand, you know, why the Constitution says this and what the heck's going on here. So all that being said, they went through this motion by Governor Morris to insert free, and for the most part, it was unanimously shot down. Nobody wanted to, you know, insert the word free. For whatever purpose, whatever reason, I think that they wanted to, you know, because Sherman was basically saying, hey, I don't see it that way. I see it in a completely different pragmatic way. So moving on, so the next area we're going to cover is actually a brand new topic. And this is one of the first times that we come across a focus in the conversation regarding immigration and citizenship. And so this really starts on page 278. And it is actually probably at the very bottom of 277 for you right now. But when you get this updated document from me, it'll be probably on 278. That being said, it starts off with Mr. Madison kind of making comments regarding citizenship and the national legislature. Now, keep in mind, this hadn't been on the table yet. And keep in mind that citizenship currently was being completely, I mean, the Articles of Confederation had no involvement in citizenship. None. As a matter of fact, the thought of a U.S. citizen really didn't exist. So this thought of a U.S. citizen to participate in, you know, the legal governing, i.e. be judge, president, representative, and so forth, It did require you be a U.S. citizen, and it required some standards. And this is where they started coming up with this. Hey, we don't think it'd be a good idea for a state to actually allow people to just come in and be a citizen for a year, and then next thing you know, they're getting, you know, jobs, or they're basically running campaigns and getting elected into the federal legislature, which is one of the reasons why they created those standards of 25 and 7 years and 35 or 30 and 10 years, whatever it is. Anyway, let's go ahead. Are you there?
Yes, sir. I'm here.
Okay, great. So let's go ahead and dive into the comments that Madison had on citizenship, and then we can kind of discuss this as they kind of move forward. Let's go ahead.
Mr. Madison was not averse to some restrictions on the subject, but could never agree to the proposed amendment. Is that the right spot?
Yep, that's right. Yeah, we're not talking about the proposed amendment. We're kind of just getting into the heat of it right here. Okay.
He thought any restriction, however, in the Constitution unnecessary and improper. Unnecessary because a national legislature is to have the right of regulating naturalization and can, by virtue thereof, fix different periods of residence as conditions of enjoying different privileges of citizenship. Improper because it will give a tincture of liberality to the Constitution, because it will put it out of the power of the national legislature, even by special acts of naturalization, to confer the full rank of citizens on meritorious strangers, and because it will discourage the most desirable class of people from immigrating to the United States. Should the proposed Constitution have the intended effect of giving stability and reputation to our governments, great numbers of respectable Europeans, men who love liberty and wish to partake its blessings, will be ready to transfer their fortunes hither. All such would feel the mortification of being marked with suspicious incapacitations, though they should not covet the public honors. He was not apprehensive that any dangerous number of strangers would be appointed by the state legislatures if they were left at liberty to do so, nor that foreign powers who make use of strangers as instruments for their purposes. Their bribes would be extended on men whose circumstances rather stifle than excite jealousy and watchfulness in the public.
Okay. Okay, so he's thinking that maybe we, you know, not put them on steroids, but let's entice these well-to-do men and families to come to America So because they're liberal-minded, they want liberty, they want to be partakers in this government. That's kind of the message he was saying, and how he thought that, you know, creating this, you know, giving the federal government the ability to control the process of naturalization could be both a tincture and a poison. That's kind of what he was alluding to. And so I think that there's probably more on this subject, so let's see what Mr. Butler says.
Mr. Butler was decidedly opposed to the admission of foreigners without a long residence in the country. They bring with them not only attachments to other countries, but ideas of government so distinct from ours that in every point of view they are dangerous. He acknowledged that if he himself had been called into public life within a short time after his coming to America, his foreign habits, opinions, and attachments would have rendered him an improper agent in public affairs. He mentioned the great strictness observed in Great Britain on this subject.
Okay, so now let's look at Mr. Franklin.
Dr. Franklin was not against a reasonable time, but should be very sorry to see anything like illiberality inserted into the Constitution. The people in Europe are friendly to this country, even in the country with which we have been lately at war. We have now and had during the war a great many friends, not only among the people at large, but in both houses of Parliament. In every other country in Europe, all the people are our friends. We found in the course of the revolution that many strangers served us faithfully and that many natives took part against their country. When foreigners, after looking about for some other country in which they can obtain more happiness, give a preference to ours, it is a proof of attachment which ought to excite our confidence and affection.
Now, you know, he was speaking at a level of understanding well above everybody else in the room, right? You know that. Because he was the chief ambassador, and he was in Europe before the war even kicked off. Yeah. He went to Europe when the Declaration of Independence was basically approved. Right after that, he was sent to the UK and became the Postmaster General. And I'm not sure if you knew this, but he was our number one spy in the UK. He was literally reading communications from the Crown and from leadership coming back that was addressed to generals and, you know, those who were, you know, overseers of the colonies. And he was reporting that to Continental Congress. He was opening the mail up and then resealing it. So he was kind of a very good, sneaky guy. But after they got wind that it was Franklin that was spying on them, I think they went to try to capture him. And he had already found himself over reassigned to France as the ambassador to France. And so he was there for quite a while. John Adams shortly came in after, and then John Adams didn't, you know, mesh very well with him. And so John Adams was reassigned and ended up going to Holland. And while he was in Holland, that first winter almost killed him because of the sledge and the air quality and the water quality was just not fit for man or beast. It literally almost killed him. And so Thomas Jefferson ended up replacing Adams in France. And so anyway, those men who aren't present, Adams and Jefferson, were still overseas at this point. Actually, I think Adams had returned. I think by this point in time, Adams had, but Jefferson hadn't. Jefferson was still over in France, I believe, or Europe somewhere. Anyway, okay, so now Mr. Randolph basically, you know, provides some more information on the topic.
Mr. Randolph did not know, but it might be problematical whether immigrations to this country were on the whole useful or not. But he could never agree to the motion for disabling them for 14 years to participate in the public honors. He reminded the convention of language held by our patriots during the Revolution and the principles laid down in all our American constitutions. Many foreigners may have fixed their fortunes among us under the faith of these invitations. All persons under this description, with all others who would be affected by such a regulation, would enlist themselves under the banners of hostility to the proposed system. He would go as far as 7 years, but no farther.
Okay, so 7 years was what they put in the House of Representatives, and 10 years, I think, for the Senate. So apparently, you know, people that resonated because that kind of worked into the Constitution. Mr. Wilson from Pennsylvania said this.
Mr. Wilson said he rose with feelings which were perhaps peculiar, mentioning the circumstances of his not being a native and the possibility, if the ideas of some gentlemen should be pursued, of his being incapacitated from holding a place under the very Constitution, which he had shared in the trust of making. He remarked the illiberal complexion with which the motion would give to the system, and the effect which a good system would have in inviting meritorious foreigners among us, and the discouragement and mortification they must feel from the degrading discrimination now proposed. He had himself experienced this mortification. On his removal into Maryland, he found himself, from defect of residence, under certain legal incapacities which never ceased to produce chagrin. Though he assuredly did not desire and would not have accepted the offices to which they related, to be appointed to a place may be a matter of indifference. To be incapable of being appointed is a circumstance grating and mortifying.
Okay. Interesting. So let's continue, because we've got Governor Morris. And let me see here, because we go up here, Mason, Pinckney, Ellsworth, Morris. So Morris was the guy that kind of made the move regarding this, these qualifications of senators and people in office. And so that's what really kind of started this. And there's only a couple little blurbs before this, before Madison kind of gets up and speaks with his level of experience, which so far seems to be shy compared to his fellow delegates. So let's go into what Mr. Governor Morris now comes back and says.
The lesson we are taught is that we should be governed as much by our reason and as little by our feelings as possible. What is the language of reason on this subject? That we should not be polite at the expense of prudence. There is a moderation in all things. It is said that some tribes of Indians carried their hospitality so far as to offer strangers their wives and daughters. Was this a proper model for us? He would admit them to his house. He would invite them to his table, would provide for them comfortable lodgings, would not carry the complaisance so far as to bed them with his wife. He would let them worship at the same altar, but not choose to make priests of them. He ran over the privileges which immigrants would enjoy among us, though they should be deprived of that of being eligible to the great offices of government, observing that they exceeded the privilege allowed to foreigners in any part of the world, and that as every society from a great nation down to a club had the right of declaring the conditions on which new members should be admitted. There could be no room for complaint. As to those philosophical gentlemen, those citizens of the world, as they call themselves, he owned he did not wish to see any of them in our public councils. He would not trust them. The men who can shake off their attachments to their own country can never love any other. These attachments are the wholesome prejudices which uphold all governments. Admit a Frenchman into your Senate, and he will study to increase the commerce of France. An Englishman, he will feel an equal bias in favor of that of England. It has been said that the legislatures will not choose foreigners, at least improper ones. There was no knowing what legislators would do. Some appointments made by them proved that everything ought to be apprehended from the cabals practiced on such occasions. He mentioned the case of a foreigner who left this state in disgrace and worked himself into an appointment from another Congress, from another to Congress. Or they might come from Somalia and work to make Somalia a better place.
So, as we can see, it started off with Madison having some, you know, equal reservations, ended with Governor Morris having some very severe reservations, but all the other men thought differently, or at least had a more tolerable view. So as they go through the motions, go ahead and do the counts.
On the motion of Mr. Governor Morris to insert 14 in the place of 4 years. New Hampshire, aye. Massachusetts, no. Connecticut, no. New Jersey, aye. Pennsylvania, no. Delaware, no. Maryland, no. Virginia, no. North Carolina, no. South Carolina, aye. Georgia, aye. On 13 years, moved Mr. Governor Morris. New Hampshire, aye. Massachusetts, no. Connecticut, no. New Jersey, aye. Pennsylvania, no. Delaware, no. Maryland, no. Virginia, no. North Carolina, no. South Carolina, aye. And Georgia, aye. So they voted the same on 14.
Identical, correct, identical. Okay, on 10 years.
On 10 years, New Hampshire voted aye. Massachusetts, no. Connecticut, no. New Jersey, aye. Pennsylvania, no. Delaware, no. Maryland, no. Virginia, no. North Carolina, no. South Carolina, aye. And Georgia, aye.
So they voted the same as they gradually lightened the burden, right, from 14 to 13 to 10. Mm-hmm. So what are your feelings and what is your perspective on why they were doing this and what the danger is in this new government of allowing people access after they've been a citizen for this many years? Because remember, to become a citizen, it is not overnight. At least today, it's a 5-year process. So on top of that, if it's 7 years, it means 12 years. You have to be here as a resident for 12 years, a citizen for 7. If you're following the naturalization laws. So what's your thoughts on this? Go ahead. And we got about 5 minutes. Go ahead.
Well, I think Mr. Governor Morris is right. I mean, how can someone leave their country, especially in this time when the country, when the United States isn't established, you know, as the beacon of freedom in the world as they are now? How is it that you're going to leave your country and come over here and then immediately be in the government? You're going to have biases and prejudices towards that country. You could have people that would use subversion, like I personally believe Hamilton was doing. But I think their trepidations are well founded.
Okay, so one of the things we haven't talked about as far as this qualification for the president being a natural born citizen. In other words, you can't be an immigrant at all to become president. And they go into the details, and we'll get to that. But the reason, as you know, hindsight being 2020, we can actually say they're wasting some time here. Possibly. Because if you're in the House of Representatives and you create, I can see, you know, creating some kind of a barrier, you know, to understand our system. And as more importantly, these men were marginalizing the system that they were creating, I think. They didn't understand that most people walking in, you know, walking out of the convention, most of the men at the convention and then walking into Congress, once the federal government was formed, some of these men actually went in there. Sherman was one. And the way they were looking at this government and what they were going to do and so forth was in conflict with how they broached it in the convention as well as the ratification debates. So right there would be a good reason of pause, because people who are associated with cabals, because that was brought up, that, you know, you have these people that are associated to cabals, whether they be foreign cabals or local cabals, right? domestic cabals or foreign cabals.
Correct.
And either way, those people that are tied and have, you know, create these biases towards their cabals are, you know, a level of threat. But what is the level of threat when it comes down to the delegated powers for what that person can actually do in office? Now we start looking at it a little differently, because we don't have general powers where these guys can make kings out of themselves. All we really need...
You didn't have power over trade.
Yeah.
I mean, that was one of the big wealth drivers at the time was trade. So, like he said, they're going to increase the commerce of France. An Englishman would increase the commerce with England.
Okay,
so they would vote and have their bias towards that might not be in the best interest of the country. It's in their own best interest.
Okay, but to be fair...
Their native country's best
interest.
Okay,
to be fair, who sets the tone for establishing the regulation of trades? It's not Congress, it's the president. And as a matter of fact, President Washington wanted to have... He wanted an administration of neutrality. He wanted to have equal trade with Britain and everybody. So, granted... There can be somebody that comes along and actually starts subverting things, and the president could actually be that guy, where Nixon basically placed China on trading status and gave them the most favored nation status, which basically gave them a priority for us to try to, you know, do as much trade with them as possible. In other words, create a conveyor belt or a money line of throwing money into China to help build up this backwards nation to become a formidable enemy at war with us. When we really look at the large scheme of things, and we look at the Constitution, I'm just, you know, this is GR's perspective. I believe that the best interest of foreign affairs, as far as identifying whether this is a friendly nation or not, literally needs to be established, and it can't be whimsical for the president. In other words, one of the things we deal with is when we change from one president to the next, and it's very frustrating for foreign nations, as well as the political ramifications that, you know, when the Democrats get in favor, they're, you know, all of a sudden these nations get favorable status and these other nations don't. And when the conservatives, Republicans, what have you, it shifts. Sometimes it doesn't, because some of the Republicans are just basically progressives in, you know, in conservative clothes. My point, and I'm looking, we're really out of time, so we need to do a go back. Because in setting these standards and policies for trade, I think it was interesting, and it was best in the mode that everybody was living in the Dark Ages in 1787, 89, 1790, and so forth. So they did what was best for the time, but I believe it's inadequate for us today. And I'm G.R. Mobley, and we're Reclaiming the Republic, and we'll bring this back up in our next show. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.